House Bill or House Finance Committee. When we left off, we were taking up House Bill. Okay, let's go. We're taking up House Bill 475, continuation of this morning's meeting. If Representative Seaton, do you know where you left off? Number 7 or 8?
I believe it was number 6.
Anyway, for the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, Co-Chairman Schnell, Co-Chairman Meyer, Representative Katula, Representative Joel, Representative Hawker, Representative Weiler.
Representative Seaton.
Oh, yeah, we also have Representative Stoltz, and we have a guest, the Minority Leader. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're on number 6, and that is that this clarifies requirements for the non-vested Tier 2 and Tier 3 employees who wish to transfer. If the employer selects to allow that option to have non-vested DB plan people, allow them to transfer into the DC plan. And this establishes a 12-month window with an extension for another 12 months after they've done that selection. It also says that if someone is transferring in there, that they have to pay for the years before they can count those years for DC plan. And this is necessary for IRS compatibility.
President Seaton, we have a question.
I just thought it might be good. I mean, I don't think anybody's really going to do this myself personally, but on the answer this morning about buying back your time and getting in, could you just, so it's clear for the record, describe what happens if somebody wants to transfer into that defined contribution plan? You know, it's the people 20 years ago, worked 2 years, who now want to come back into the plan. And if they wanted to go to the defined contribution rather than the defined benefit plan, how they'd have to do that. So that we're clear on the record for the future.
And through the chair, Representative Curtula, before we have two elements here. First is someone coming back into the system, whichever system it is, and that is a provision that they could do that through 2010, and they would have to initiate their buyback. This is someone that was employed who got applied and got all their money refunded to them and then left the system and is now coming back. So they would have to start that process, initiate it before 2010. The conversion from the DB plan to the DC plan is for only people that are not vested in the DB plan, first of all. The employer must make a selection that they are going to make this, open this window for employees to do this. Before they'll do that, they will get from the Division of Retirement Benefits an accounting of their liability. Because the liability could be large. If you look at a TERS employee, they could have 6 years of employment under a DB plan, come in, get hired, and if that window was open, then they could convert to the DC plan, would be immediately vested. They might only work 1 year, but the requirements under the Employment Security Act was that the employer must make the deposits equaling what they made previously. So it's a liability on employers, so they need to figure out how many people are qualified to do that, because they can't limit it to a certain person. If they open it up, it's opened up. And that's why the window is a 12-month window, so that the employer can assess their liability. Otherwise, if they opened up the window and it was open for 10 years and they hired somebody, all of a sudden it could cost them several hundred thousand dollars in deposits. And so then the person would have to make that selection. Before that selection is done, the division would give them a individual analysis of where they're at under the two plans, whether the DB plan and the DC plan, and what their benefits in the future would be.
Great, and I think you also said that the employer has to allow it too. Was that the other part of that, that they have to agree that they can transfer into DC before anybody will be allowed to do that? Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Curtula, that is correct. The employer must make a selection with the division, and that is open for 12 months. and they can make a second selection for another 12 consecutive months, and that's the two options for doing that.
Thank you.
We now have Section 7 that clarifies the basis for calculating employer contribution rates. Oh, if I could have my staff.
Go ahead.
Okay. Staff Representative Seaton, the contribution rates have previously all been calculated on the entire wage basis. This is the normal cost rate, the past service cost rate, and the employer contribution rates. With the adoption of a Tier 4, the Tier 4 employees do not have a past service cost associated with them. But that's the nature of the defined contribution program. However, for accounting purposes, this language clarifies that when you calculate the past service cost rate that will be applied to the employer, it will be applied to the entire wage base, which means it will include the salaries of your defined contribution and your defined benefit employees. It's the same dollar amount, which is called the past service cost, and in order to maintain consistency, and especially all the documents that we have looked at, you know, look at this growing past service cost rate as applied to the entire wage base. So really this is an accounting measure for consistency. It doesn't change the actual dollar amount that employers will be required to pay.
And just for a little clarification, that's where we amortize over the 25 years what the employer's past service cost rate is, and that's based on a 1% employee growth and those things. It came up with that 30 to 44% of wages that you would have to do when the final plan got adopted. The word system got changed to plan, which meant it went to, it didn't include everybody. And so all this does is make it consistent with everything that was done in the tier committees and everything. Number 8 is it gives the regulatory authority to the appropriate party. And 141, it assigns regulatory authority to the Armed Board, and really that goes to the commissioner. And so this just reassigns it to the commissioner. There is changes, the basis for calculating the HRA, and this is on the, and of course this is the policy as we had discussed it, and that was that it would be 3% of the average wage across the entire employer groups. And when it got adopted, that's where it went and said plan, and a plan is per employer. So you could have some discrimination by a group that paid more. They could be contributing more into their HRA than one that had lower paid employees. And this means that everybody gets exactly the same contribution rate into their HRA. And also necessary for IRS. We also changed a bunch of definitions, and there's a disallowing of employment with NEA counting towards Tier 4 retirement. That was disallowed previously, and it's really not applicable, but just got incorporated, a section that got pulled into 141 when they were writing things. And so that's really the current status of things. NEA employees don't participate in Tier 1, 2, or Tier 3 either. Establishes provisions for employer termination for participation of the plan. Currently, an employer can terminate from the defined benefit program. That was an omission from Senate Bill 141. There was no mechanism built in to allow an employer at some time to say, we want to opt out of the entire program with the state. And so this puts in the provisions so that they can do that from the DC plan as well as the DB plan. We clarified that the benefit and defined contribution components of the plan, and we talked a little about those earlier, and we established that there's adherence to the IRS limitations. Those limitations are maximum amounts that can be contributed by an individual, et cetera. And that could also apply to someone that is converting from a DB plan to the DC plan. You can only take in, I think it's $44,000. Somebody might have more money than that, and they'd be limited to that. But, of course, retirement benefits will notify them of that in their individual accounting. Mr. Chairman, I'm You've got a memorandum that we gave you about the differences between version I, which is what came out of State Affairs, and version L. I talked about the differences between S and L being just those drafting errors and that one section about Buck. I can go through those if you want. Those are predominantly all based on the Ice Miller RFP that came back in the study of how to make sure that everything's IRS compliant. So if you're interested, we can go through that. If not, you've had it to read. We've also got the sectionals. You've got two sets of them. And the one that's easiest is the abbreviated sectional that talks about the issues. But if anybody has any questions or if you want me to go through that, whatever you prefer, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, let's. I think it's best at this point in time, Rich Sinseaton, just to take questions from the committee members. Because you're right, all this information is in our packet. Hopefully everyone has had a chance to read the packet. Representative Warwick, you have a question?
I have a question. One of the things we've talked about, is, Mr. Chairman, is addressing those members, or excuse me, employers in the systems who are in an overfunded status. And Representative Seaton and I had talked about potentially putting language in the bill to address that, and I don't really think that's necessary, but I did want to ask the sponsor if what I had written there is his intent, because if that is your intent, that would have weight during any interpretation of the statute we were going to adopt and implementation by the executive branch of this underfunded. And if that's correct, if you want to just read that into the record, that I think would make it clear your intent.
Through the chair, yes, this was as intent language. It is my intent in this bill that sections 3, 38, 77, 79, and 80 apply only to employers who are overfunded. The application of these sections would not legally allow employers' funding status to drop below 100%.
And I think that takes care of that and without having to deal with the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Robert. Question? Go ahead.
I did have a follow-up on your bill analysis. One of the things I had been concerned about is whether the adoption of the provisions had required some sort of a letter ruling by the IRS. And your analysis on page 3 indicates that if the amendment isn't adopted, the IRS may not recognize and apply the special rules of the Section 414K structure, which may result in an IRS plan determination failure. And I had understood in the letter I distributed to you in the committee that the question was whether the Tier 4 required some sort of letter ruling by the IRS, and the short answer was no. So what's the distinction here? There seems to be some difference between your statement and what the division's position is. Maybe I'm confused.
And Mr. Representative Wyrock, through the chair, what the difference is that after there's a plan in place, the IRS will review that and will certify, and we can get retirement benefits. I believe they're here. My understanding is that they will then review that and say that it's in compliance or not.
That does run headlong, and what it looks like the advice from the division is. And also in your analysis, it says without the change, the plan is discriminatory and would not qualify for IRS tax exempt status. So that also seems to run contrary to what the division's position is. Maybe they can clarify that.
That'd be fine.
But I don't want to hog.
Okay, sure. Well, we have them up next, I believe. Any other questions for the sponsor, Representative Couture?
If an employer opts out of the defined contribution plan, decides not to participate, what happens to the employees? Do they have to go and do they have to get Social Security at that point, or have you talked about that?
Representative Curtula, through the chair, if an employer opts out, the employees immediately become vested in the plan. So anybody that's unvested would immediately become vested. And what the employer does beyond that point, I don't know. I mean, they could probably opt into some other plan as well, but I'll maybe we can get retirement benefits, come up here to talk about that.
And are those mostly municipalities? Or, I mean, this doesn't allow this. I mean, we're doing this because of the state. I just hadn't thought that through. I mean, the state can't just opt out now. I mean, we'd have to come back and redo all of this, right? I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? It's not the state opting out.
Senator, or Representative Cotula through the chair. Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding is that that would be fully in. And there's about 155 different employers, and that includes school districts as well as municipalities.
Okay. But, thank you.
Great. Any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Seaton. Kate? And why don't we go ahead and bring someone up from the administration, Melanie Milhorn? Tracy, I have you wanting to testify too, so you're just going to work with them.
Sure, I'm just
here. Yeah.
To answer questions.
Good to see you again.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, the first question was posed by Representative Wyrock, and I believe the question that the division responded back to Representative Wyrock, I believe the question was, does the division require any rulings right now from the Internal Revenue Service in order to implement Senate Bill 141? And the response from the division was no. We do not require right now any rulings from the Internal Revenue Service in order to implement the plan on July 1 of 2006. However, what the division has done is that we have worked very, very closely with Ice Miller, and Ice Miller is our legal tax advisors over the course of the last couple of months, and especially as committee substitute for House Bill 475. They've recently reviewed that entire bill and provided their recommendations in order to conform those benefit provisions with the Internal Revenue Service. And what we're seeking to do at this point is obtain plan determination letters and private letter rulings as a result of incorporating these provisions found in House Bill 475 in order that we can favorably receive plan determination letters. It takes some period of time for the Internal Revenue Service to provide those plan determination letters, and a private letter ruling follows. It's almost a year period it can be for a private letter ruling. So I think that that's the difference between my response to Representative Wyrock saying we don't need any rulings right now in order to implement Senate Bill 141.
Representative
Thank you. No, I have no follow-up.
No follow-up?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I think we had another question, Representative Cotula.
Yeah, about what happened to people if their employer opted out of the defined contribution plan. Would the employer be required to do Social Security then, or do we know what happens?
They would have to have some kind of retirement or pension system in place, or Social Security would satisfy that. I would also like to comment back with the, if I could, with regard to our pursuit of a plan determination letter for FERS and TERS, our new defined contribution plans, and a private letter ruling. We need to have these plan provisions adopted and have this bill passed out of committee and enacted by the legislature in order to avoid a plan determination failure, which would have adverse consequences to the members and the employers. So it's very, very important, and we're seeking your support in order that we have the tools available in order to receive those favorable rulings.
I do have a question.
What if this bill did not pass this year? What if it, and then we realized there were some other problems we had after the effective date on July 1st? If we were to come back next session, could we pass something retroactive to July 1st, 2006?
I think in response to your question, there's a number of adverse impacts that would result if this bill was not passed. Some of those include that the funding that's found in Section 73 and 77, the employers would not be funding the death and disability benefits properly. And in order to satisfy the actuarial soundness when you establish those trust funds in order to pay those benefits out of, we need to be able to have the employers pay for those. And those benefits are very, very important. So that would be an adverse impact, as those employers would not be funding those benefits that members would be due those entitlements out of. There's also a number of issues that I will ask Jenna, our assistant AG, to address that would result in disputes about benefits and entitlements about those benefits that, if this bill doesn't pass, will allow disputes to arise, and she's going to have to represent us regarding those. Do you want to talk to that issue?
Well, if I may, I'm not sure I'm completely comfortable with the answer, because my concern is this goes in effect July 1st, mm-hmm. and then we find something in find out in August or October or November or something, oh man, here's another error we made. Then when we come into session in January, can we fix that and make it retroactive? Or are we better off postponing the effective date of the retirement bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that there's any advantage whatsoever from postponing this. I believe that those changes that are encompassed in 475 address all of the issues for proper implementation associated with this bill.
All right. So you wanted, what was your name?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Virginia Regal, Assistant Attorney General. I represent the Division of Retirement and Benefits. One of the issues that the director was alluding to was a current provision of the law that appears to allow a dependent on a deceased member to continue receiving an ongoing survivor benefit after that dependent is no longer of age to be considered a child. That kind of distribution of benefits would not be allowed under the federal tax code that requires distributions to dependents to be made to people who are children under a certain age, or children who are in college and also under a slightly higher age. If that is not changed, the dependents of members who sign up in the system starting July 1st could argue that they have a vested right to acquire those benefits if they ever become survivors entitled to benefits. The problem is that our Constitution does not allow us to change or diminish benefits once a member has been vested in those benefits by virtue of employment with the state or a political subdivision participating in her. So that is one instance where the vesting of benefits under our Constitution makes not making a change now problematic. It's better to make the change now so that no rights vest in that provision starting July 1st.
Question by Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You guys told me the same thing across this table last year when I asked the question, that I didn't think this plan was going to qualify, considering the provisions that was in the harassed process that we were under trying to get this through last year. It did not undergo a proper judicious review of the program, evidenced by a 34-page bill, 78 sections, whatever it is. I see in your section, no less than 11 statements that we have to make this, or in some version of it won't qualify or it'll fail an IRS determination. I see at least two, if not more, statements that we, if we don't do it, we won't have a funding source from which to pay benefits. And now you're telling me that what you have just stated was that, yep, we need to go ahead and keep, you know, and do this because now it's perfect. I don't have a lot more comfort with this approach than I had last year. I think I stand vindicated on my concerns from last year. So would it not be wiser to defer the effective date of the entire massive change here while you have a chance to potentially take these amendments, incorporate them, get them re-reviewed by competent legal services, which, you know, you said you just engaged somebody here recently to go over this bill. It seems, once again, we've got our cart so far before our horse that it's not a responsible course of action.
And through the chair, Representative Hawker, one particular area that is very, very important is that these provisions that were passed last session are unique. They're unique in the sense that this is a hybrid plan. The legislature has conferred benefits on members, that certain benefits are fixed and guaranteed that are DB benefits, and certain benefits are DC benefits. And I remember sitting here a year ago when that discussion happened, right in this room, and what we said was, if you have a DB benefit, there's going to be some challenges associated with that. Well, part of meeting that challenge is to have legal tax advice that the Department of Law has secured for us. That's a very, very specialized field when people provide legal tax advice to government pension systems. And we have a team of three attorneys that have looked at this. They're very, very competent. Two of them are partners in this law firm, Eisenhower. They've gone through this bill. They've provided their recommendation. One of the partners for that bill, or that bill review, is named Mary Beth Breitman, and she worked in the Internal Revenue Service for 10 years on plan compliant issues. This is not something that is expertise that's easily found. The Department of Law didn't have that expertise. We secured that expertise because we recognized that the legislature wanted certain benefits for those members, and we intend to meet those benefits. And we told Eismiller, you are our legal tax advisors. You do whatever it takes to figure out that these benefits that are DB and DC are now a hybrid plan, and we want language that provides those benefits that the legislature intended for those members. So it's not something that happens immediately, but that due diligence associated with that process has been undertaken, and it's been complete. And the Department of Law spent some period of time after the bill was enacted, Jenna Regal being the party who did that, who did the bill analysis and identified every single issue that was not immediately identified last legislative session, because it was a lengthy bill. There's a number of complexities associated with that bill. So we feel very, very comfortable at this point, and we're here before you because we don't believe it's too late. We believe, give us the tools, the time is right, we want to do it right, we just want to do it once.
Yes, that you have just exactly made my case that we ought not be conferring benefits statutorily until we know exactly what benefits we're conferring, exactly what the consequences are, and we are absolutely certain that we have met what is the, whatever the intent of the legislature is. And, again, with this massive a change to an already very complex bill, I would submit I'm not so sure I'd want to be testifying that you guarantee me that this gets us exactly where you think our intent is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Any other questions? Welcome, Representative Holm. For the record, you've been here for quite a while. Sorry. Any other, Representative Katula?
Well, I think it's in the section that that Ms. Regal was talking about with children being able to continue to get benefits, but I was just a little, I needed an explanation, and it's in section 16 and talking about when you have a death of a disabled member, and it's the language that talks about, well, the monthly survivor's pension is being paid, then the survivor is not entitled to elect distributions from the individual contribution. So my question is, do they get to the point where they can? Is it the pension runs out and then they can get the individual contribution, or is that just foregone? I just didn't understand how that worked.
The way this is structured now, through the chair, Representative Curtula, it does provide that a survivor is not entitled to elect distributions for the employee's individual contribution account under AS 1425-410 while they're receiving the survivor benefit. The concern was the way the bill was originally enacted last year. It seemed not to have been taken into account that a person could not get a disability or survivor benefit until they had terminated employment. And it was not taken into account that termination of employment is a triggering time for a person to be able to take distributions from an account. Allowing distributions from the account at that time would seem to thwart the legislature's purpose that the account accrue money in order to pay a retirement benefit later once the survivor benefits end. This bill has also now been changed to acknowledge the fact that this is a hybrid plan, and the member will still not be allowed to take distributions from the employee account. But also, as I understand it, there will be no further contributions to that account by the employer, but a new survivor benefit, a new benefit, retirement benefit for the survivor is being set up here later on, like on lines 12 and about to down to 23, I believe. A survivor benefit or retirement benefit after the survivor benefit ends based on the amount that would have gone to the account. That was based on advice by our expert outside counsel to make this a true hybrid plan and to make it comply with contributions that are allowed to be made on behalf of the survivor under the tax code.
Okay, follow up.
Well, so it's called a pension here. So that's the benefit. Once they're done with the pension, then they can go into the contributions, and that the employer would have had to have made contributions just as if the employee was still alive. Or am I still missing it?
The employer will have to make contributions to that, and the amount of the benefit later available to the survivor will be based on the amount that would have been made. Contributions that would have been made on behalf of the employee.
Okay. So it's just after the pension is gone, then they get to go into the other account.
I see. After the survivor pension, I believe.
Right.
Is gone.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kula. Any other questions?
Well,
did anybody else want to testify amongst the three of you there? Okay.
I also wondered, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to go look, about what we do now on occupational disability. I just noticed that there's a new definition there, and I just wondered if it tracks with what we do currently or if there's a change to what the bill does with occupational disability.
Thanks. The new definition of occupational disability is slightly different than the definition of occupational disability under the defined benefit plan that the Alaska Supreme Court has construed as allowing a continuation of occupational disability benefits after a member is capable of comparable employment, but that employment is not made available to that particular person by a plan member. This definition of occupational disability includes the concept that if comparable employment is available from another kind of employer besides a PERS employer, that would also result in an end of occupational disability benefits.
Just to follow up, so right now, if there were comparable work available, the person might conceivably still not be, they still might not be put off benefits. They would still maybe be able to continue to get them, and this is more of a bright line. Is that the way it's going to work?
I don't know if it's more of a bright line. It's just it makes the statute for defined contribution plan members comport with the way the division had division's long-term interpretation of occupational disability, that comparable employment would be available from not just a PERS employer, but from other kinds of employer, including self-employment that's highly remunerative, could result in the end of occupational disability benefits.
And maybe if I could follow up Jenna Ragel's comments. The Alaska Supreme Court decision is referred to as the Morton case. And in that particular instance, the person who was receiving those disability benefits actually received a higher benefit after he was disabled because he was employed in certain capacities. And the division said, no, we're going to discontinue your benefits because you are above 75%. And the Alaska Supreme Court looked at that particular definition, and because there was not an offer made from another PERS employer, he was actually self-employed. He had a bachelor's degree, he was a psychological counselor, and his wages were above his PERS wages, but he continues to receive a PERS disability benefit because it's not a comparable position to the position he left as a correctional officer. And it was not an offer that was made to him from another PERS employer that would allow us to discontinue those benefits.
Thank you. Could I get a copy? Sure. Could I ask for a copy of the case so that I could take a look at it, too? Thanks. And I just have one last question from the bill. We move it back and forth. And that was, I think, it was good timing.
Restraint.
The Zen height. And that was, this is probably...
Good time.
I think this relates back to what Representative Seaton was talking about in terms of the credits. And I just wanted to be sure. On Section 40 of the new CS... And I'm sorry, I'm looking at the one from last night, I think, not this morning. So it may not be quite the same section. But it talks about credited service for which contributions were refunded is not creditable under this section. And again, I haven't had time to tie that back into the statute itself. And it just made me a little bit nervous that the credited service isn't creditable. And I just, what does that apply to? Is that to being able to come back? I mean, or is it just a necessary cleanup language? Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Kutula, in last year's bill, SB 141, a number of provisions were taken out effective 2010, allowing reinstatement of service. This one was, I believe, inadvertently not caught in that process. This is just another provision having to do with reinstatement of service that's being taken out effective 2010, consistent with the changes that were made by SB 141.
And you agree with what Representative Seaton said about how somebody could come back in and, you know, they had invested previously and could repay and come back into the service. They don't have to refund all at once. They just have to start before 2010, and then they can continue to pay after that. Is that right?
I believe that's the way the division intends to implement this.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much. We want to stand by. We have somebody holding online on teleconference. Nancy Duez with the Fairbanks Education Association. She is still with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Nancy, go ahead, please.
Well, listening to all the testimony, I guess I just get more confused on all the implications of this piece of legislation. But I feel that the public employees and the teacher retirement system, you know, it's too important of an issue to rush into quickly and to not take into consideration all the factors that are going to affect these employees as they retire. We're looking, if I did my math right, we're looking at implementation in 11 weeks. And I think there are a lot of things that are unanswered as far as how this really does affect the employees and how it's going to be administered and how it's, what an impact it's going to have on the cost to the state to administer it. And what I actually came here today was to ask for a delay of Senate Bill 141, which I was glad to hear some of the discussion leaning that way so that those questions could be answered and so that we could actually look at a way to reduce that unfunded liability, which is something Senate Bill 141 does not take care of, and if anything, maybe actually increases it. But in listening to this testimony from Melanie Melhorn, I have a question. She's, and it relates to whether or not employers choose to opt out of the system, and she made comments that then the employees would immediately become vested in the system. And then another question related to what would happen with retirement, and she said possibly Social Security, but it's my understanding, and perhaps someone there can clarify and straighten me out on this, that if you're vested in the system, then you come under Social Security windfall elimination provision and government pension offset. So I just wonder how that's going to affect the possibility of these new employees getting Social Security, if someone can answer that question.
Oh, okay. Why don't we hold that until we're done with the public testimony?
Nancy. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else online? Okay. Let's go back to Anchorage Juno. Tom Harvey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Meyer. And my name is Tom Harvey. I'm the Executive Director of NEA Alaska. NEA Alaska represents over 11,400 active public school employees and over 1,300 retirees, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on HB 475. I believe you have my written testimony, and so I'm not going to read it into the record. I would like to make one note, and I appreciate Co-Chair Chenault pointing out to me that on the second page, in the third line of the second page, towards the end of that third line, what assumptions will be used for this calculation? I won't make any reference to what that word, a transposition of those letters, results in. Let me begin by suggesting to this body, as the House Finance Committee, that AS 2408036 puts a specific burden on this body, and I don't know that that burden has been met. Specifically, let me reference the whole issue of the present retirement plans that are going to be closed, and thus the payroll-based contributions will be reduced. There was testimony that there was no impact on the systems last year. And today we know better. The administration has actually informed particular bodies that, quote, employer rates for past service costs will continue to rise as amortized liability is applied to a shrinking payroll paid to members of the defined benefits plan. Thus, I do believe that there has been an increased liability created. And I don't know if you know whether that's true or not. I do think it's your responsibility to find out. And therefore, I would suggest that you amend HB 475 by delaying the implementation of SB 141 until July 1, 2008. I also am a trustee of a retirement plan for employees, and recently I went through the IRS determination process, and I would suggest to this body that you want to have it right before you implement, instead of implementing and then finding out that you have to go through a different kind of process with the IRS. We were fortunate because the prior to my being the executive director, the plan was not in compliance. I recognized that, and we applied for a voluntary compliance process with the IRS. It took us almost 2 years to complete the process. I would suggest that you want it right before you implement, not, and if you have letters coming that are suggesting that they'll give you opinions, then you ought to wait to get those letters and find out. I would also suggest to you that the proposal to delay the effective date until 2008 of the provision in SB 141 that establishes a floor on employer contributions does not add liability to the plans and ultimately to the taxpayers. It is curious to me that if these are unfunded plans, but we have some employers who have overpaid, then that means there are other employers who are drastically underpaid, since we have unfunded plans. If you delay the date in which those who are underpaid, because you are delaying the date for everybody, don't have to meet minimum contributions, aren't you in fact increasing the liability of the two plans, or of the present plan? I would suggest that at a minimum, you need to look at a method by which you can extend to those employers who have overpaid an opportunity to recover the overpayment, but that to the rest of the group, they need to be paying a minimum rate and not being allowed to be paid underneath that normal rate. So again, I would suggest to you that before you get an answer to that, you need to delay the implementation of this bill. Clarifying the provisions regarding how death and disability benefits will be funded. I was curious to hear the explanation that those death and disability benefits are not exactly the same as the defined benefit plans provide. And the reason for that was a Supreme Court case here. I think that's a policy decision. I thought I heard last year that this legislature wanted to provide the same death and disability benefits to police and firefighters as was in the present plan. But I'm hearing today that that's not the case. That may be a good, prudent decision by the legislature, but the sponsor of the bill indicated that there would be no policy changes. I think that's a policy question, and I think that deserves debate. And therefore, I believe it is prudent to delay the implementation by amending HB 475 to do that. I would also seek clarification on the rationale for the amendment to clarify the basis for calculating employer contribution rates. Very honestly, I did not follow all of that, but when I read that it says that the cost would, the past service cost rate would escalate to over 100%. I'm not sure I understand why that's a problem. Because SB 141 changed the way the ad hoc post-retirement pension adjustment is awarded. It requires that the funds reach 105%. So what would be wrong with having a contribution rate over 100% if we want to get to over 105% before retirees get a post-retirement pension adjustment? I don't know if you know the answers to that. If you do, I'd like to hear them. If you don't, I would suggest that it would be prudent to amend HB 475 and delay the implementation of SB 141 until July 1, 2008. There are several other questions I raise in my written testimony. I would make one observation. The specific section of the bill that addresses the National Education Association in Alaska, we support that amendment. We are no longer qualified as a TERS or a PERS employer, and so your statutes should not reference us as an employer. We are proud to be able to provide our own retirement system to our employees. Before I close my remarks, I do want to draw your attention to a comment in my written testimony. I want to make it clear that NEA Alaska's criticism of HB 475, which is really a failing grade for SB 141, is not a reflection on the sponsor, Representative Seaton. We believe that if he and the House State Affairs Committee had been given the time to develop the original HB 238 last year, it would have led to a blended plan, a hybrid solution that might have met our approval and been a good solution for all parties. The committee wasn't given the time, and so now I ask that the time be provided and by again amending HB 475 to delay the implementation of SB 141 until July 1, 2008. You know where we stand on defined benefit versus defined contribution, but that's not the point today. The point today is, as Yogi Berra said, it seems like deja vu all over again. We weren't given the time last year, and we have a pretty complicated bill in front of us this year. I hope we don't do what we did last year. I hope what we do is give us the time to get it done right so that we are IRS compliant and that we do provide the right benefits that this legislature wants to provide to the public employees in the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Any questions for Representative Chenault?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Tom, you stated that the NEA was in favor of the amendment to take NEA out of the bill.
Yes, sir.
And that's because you guys are covered by your own plan?
Yes, sir.
Is that a DB plan or a DC plan or a hybrid?
It was a DB plan for many years. It became a DC plan at the request of the employees. And then they requested that it return to a DB plan, but they made the request 5 years after the conversion, and the cost to go back was too high at that point in time. They regret the decision to go to a DC plan.
So currently you're under a DC plan.
Currently they're under a DC plan, and they regret it.
Okay. Thanks, sir.
And may I add,
Mr. Chairman, that our staff are far more highly compensated than the public employees in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Okay. All right, thank you.
Let's go next to Jim Duncan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Duncan. I am the business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association. We represent, depending on what day of the week it is, about 7,500 general government unit members who work for the state of Alaska. My testimony will be very brief. I just want to restate, I don't think anyone's surprised here, of course, we do oppose a defined contribution plan. We opposed that last year and we continue that opposition. However, I also want to be sure, knowing that the legislature has put that plan into place, has passed the statute, and if nothing changes, it will take place this July 1st, 06, that when our future members, when members enter into that plan, our future members enter into that plan, that it's a plan that will work and will serve them. I want to focus my attention, I don't believe this plan will do that at this time, I want to focus my attention just on the question of the IRS determination, because I think that is a very important question for you all to consider as you move forward. What will the IRS say about the defined contribution plan that you enacted last year? I heard Ms. Milhorn say that clearly a plan determination failure would have adverse impact on plan participants. And major adverse impact on plan participants. I don't think there's any question about that. I also do not believe that you can prejudge what the IRS is going to say, no matter how good a consultant you have, how good of an attorney you have that looks at the plan, that you cannot prejudge what IRS is going to say concerning the DC plan and whether the changes that you have here in House Bill 475 will bring it into compliance after they have reviewed that. I've done many things in my life, many of them which I'm proud of, but many different varied backgrounds. I claim to be an expert in any one of them, but I've done a lot of different things, including working for the state of Alaska in a professional position in the income tax division as the head of the audit division back in the early 70s, including working in the financial field in a number of areas. I'm not a CPA, but I have been a financial planner, and I have advised clients regarding financial planning and what they intended to do and their questions about the IRS. And my response to them, there's only two things I think you can be sure of when it comes to the IRS. One is that you will pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And the second is that you never know what an IRS determination is going to be, no matter how good your advice is or how good your consultants is, until you actually see that determination letter written by the IRS. You cannot prejudge what they're going to say. I believe you need to be very cautious in this area. I do concur that if you enter people into a defined contribution plan in July of 06 and it isn't compliant, if the changes you make in 475 are not compliant, do not bring it into compliance, and the IRS determines it is not, you are going to have major adverse impact on plan participants. For representing those future members, I don't want to see that happen, and I hope you would not want to see that happen. I would encourage you, as was suggested here earlier, to consider a delayed effective date on the implementation of the defined contribution plan. Ms. Milhorn, I think, testified that it may take nearly a year to get a final determination. So I believe at a minimum, you should delay the effective date of the defined contribution plan to 7107, 7108 to be on the safe side, but a one-year delayed effective date, without doubt, would at least give you a feeling as to whether the plan you put in place is going to be successful and be in compliance. Chairman, I hope you'll give that very serious consideration, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Any questions? Representative Cotula.
If you get
And is it called a failure, a plan determination failure? The IRS rules adversely to the state. What can be done at that point to rectify it? Do we have to go back? Do we have to change things? And what happens to the employees in the interim?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I understood the question from Representative Curtula, if we have members, in the plan after 7106 and the IRS determines that it's not compliant, that it's not in compliance, what happens to those folks? Well, there's a number. I don't have a list of the adverse impacts that Ms. Milhorn went through. I heard this morning the fact that the employee and employer contribution would both be taxable, for one. A major impact. That's a major impact on plan participants. It is not designed to have those employer contributions and employee contributions be taxable. They're supposed to be pre-tax contributions. If it's not compliance, that's the outcome. And that means that has a major impact on the active employees, and it has a major impact on their future retirement benefits. There may be, and I think the retirement benefits was going through some of those, there may be other adverse impacts, but clearly that, in my mind, is not something to say, well, if we don't get compliance, this is what will happen, but we shouldn't worry too much about it. I think you should worry a lot about that, so I would urge you to go cautiously in this area.
Thank you.
No other questions? Thank you, Mr. Representative Wyrock.
I don't have a question for this witness, Mr. Chairman, but I did have one on a legal issue for Ms. Milhorn and Ms. Regal after this okay. panel is finished.
Yeah, if after Mr. Duncan's through, I'll bring Ms. Milhorn back up.
And Ms. Regal.
Jim, welcome to
your
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Milhorn, Regal.
Ms. Regal, Jenna Regal.
The assistant AG like yes. to come back up?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Wyrock.
Thanks. Last year there was some issue under AS 2408036, which requires fiscal notes on bills affecting state retirement systems, and that in addition to the fiscal notes on a bill, there has to be an analysis of the long and short-term cost to the state if the bill is adopted. And I was just looking at the fiscal note that accompanies the bill. Is this legally sufficient to meet the requirements of 2408036? Is that's the question? And then I have a follow-up. You want to keep it, right?
Okay. To the chair, Representative Wyrock, I believe that this complies with the requirements of the statute decided.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the other question is listening to this IRS stuff, I don't know what to... To me, the IRS is a black hole. But I just was thinking, based on what I've heard about IRS, if, and this is in the nature of proposed amendment, but is this proposed amendment necessary? If the IRS issues a noncompliance letter and PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3 plans implemented by this act are noncompliant, then the effective date of the act shall be delayed until these plans comply with the IRS. Is that needed? Something like that to hedge the risk?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, if the plan actually goes into effect on July 1st, it's very difficult to understand how the language you propose would actually have effect.
Well, the second section of the amendment is this. Employees hired after June 30, 2006 shall be considered hired on June 30, 2006 if Section A becomes a reality. In other words, if IRS issues noncompliance, you have to have some way for those employees who would have been covered to be covered, right? So they kick back as a fiction to be treated as employees hired on June 30th. That gives the state and IRS the opportunity to work through the compliance. But those employees haven't fallen through a crack. They're Tier 3, Tier 2 employees for PERS TERS.
Through the chair, Representative Weirach. There still could be vesting problems with employees in the DC plan who arguably have rights under that plan that they don't want to relinquish by going back to a Tier 3 or Tier 2. If the language proposed also had specific indication that no rights vest under this plan if this happens, that might... It might work better if there was a later challenge.
Well, I guess the key question is how do we address the risk, the IRS risk?
Okay. I don't know how to do it. I'm just trying to come up with a way to do it, and I don't know the answer.
Okay. Ty, before we get too much further with questions from the committee, I wanted to see if there's anyone else who wanted to testify, and I know Nancy has a question also for Fairbanks. But is there anyone else here?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, we'll go ahead and close the public testimony then. And I think your question is a follow-up to Representative Weirach, and then we'll go to Ms. Duez. Representative Couture?
Well, my question, I think I'm thinking in the same direction as Representative Weirach. But what if we said that the plan is contingent upon a favorable ruling by the IRS? That way, we're covering ourselves. I mean, we get the favorable ruling by the IRS, and then the plan comes into effect. So we don't create any of the liabilities, but we also don't step out until we know that we're approved. Would that do it? I mean, I think I'm thinking the same thing as Representative Weirach, only we get the ruling first, and then contingent upon that, everything comes into effect.
Through the chair, Representative Kachula. Again, you would have to have a delayed effective date in order for that to work, I would think. Mm-hmm. And it could not go into effect this coming July, because you're surely not going to receive an IRS ruling by this July.
I guess that would be true. You'd have to change the current plan, but I mean, it would only be delayed until the time that you got you got the ruling from the IRS. So we'd be, I don't know, I mean, my previous life, that'd be the way to make it completely safe, it seems to me. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Different question or same along the same lines?
As long as you're still in public testimony, I can wait.
No, I'm done with public testimony, but I have a question on somebody who's online.
Just a comment on that issue.
Sure.
Very common with the IRS that you make a change in the plan, that you face this. They don't like to play what-if games. They like to play gotcha games afterwards. And one way of taking care of if you have a concern, which this would only affect new employees, so a simple way to do that, I guess, or one way to do it, would be to notice those employees that, you know, you're coming to work with us with full knowledge of the fact that we're asking for an IRS ruling. If it doesn't happen, that portion for this year or until the ruling is complete could be taxable and come aboard, with their own, with the risk. But this is very, very common that the IRS, I faced it in our organization with certain changes, and very common that they don't allow you to get perfectly comfortable with it. And we've already had a year, and to delay another year for that reason would be that would not be normal in the outside world at all.
Okay, I'm going to go to Nancy. Let's take her question, and then we'll call it a day for today, and take this bill up then next week when we return. So, Nancy, what was your question? If you could repeat it, please.
First of all, thank you for entertaining the question. The comment from Melanie Melhorn was that if an employer chose to opt out, then perhaps they would offer Social Security. But she also said that once that happened, the employees would automatically be vested in the system. And as you all know, Alaska is a non-Social Security state. And as of July 1, if this goes into effect, we will be the only non-Social Security state with a defined contribution system. So if those employers opt out, and then that means those employees are automatically vested, would they then, my understanding then, once you're vested, you are subject to the Social Security windfall elimination provision and government pension offset. And I just want to know if that is accurate and how that, if thought has been given to the impact it would have on these employees, given that they are not entitled to Social Security. Even though I have my 40 quarters in, I'm not going to get the full benefit of Social Security that I get in my little annual statement that says I'm going to get.
Ms. Milhorn?
I'm not sure that I understand the question fully, but perhaps perhaps with a little bit more clarification, I would be able to do that. But essentially, right now, under the DB plan, employees are subject to the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset in relation to a benefit that they would receive from Social Security if they have a benefit. So once a member leaves the system, they're still subject to the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. If they work for an employer that participates in Social Security, they would continue to earn benefits under the Social Security system, and I believe that after 30 years that the windfall elimination provision, the government pension offset, is not applicable. But I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question.
Nancy, you got a follow-up, or would you like to maybe call Ms. Milhorn and you can work it out?
Well, I just think that's something that I'm hoping that everybody that's dealing with this retirement issue is taking into consideration, is the fact that the public employees and the teachers do not have that benefit of Social Security as somewhat of a safety net for reliable monies after they retire. And yes, I may be contacting Ms. Milhorn just to get clarification on that, because the other thought is, you know, if your employer chooses to not participate, gosh, if I was 40 and they decided not to participate and I had to work in the private sector another 30 years to get my Social Security, it's not a very pleasant thought to be 70-something and still working.
Can you follow up, Ms. Milhorn?
I'd be happy to talk to Nancy offline if that's possible. That would be great.
When
we bring this back up, would you bring us back the, not necessarily the conversation you had, but the results of the conversation? Dealing with her questions so that the committee members will know.
I feel compelled to, as this discussion has moved along, to make some comments. What we really are seeking to do is, we've received expert tax advice that have told us exactly what we need to do to implement this, and we're seeking plan determination letters and private letter rulings as a result of that. What would happen if this is not successful is we believe that would result in a plan qualification failure. However, at that point, it's our understanding from our legal tax advisors that you work out those remedies with the Internal Revenue Service on how to go forward, so there would be another opportunity associated with correcting those issues. So I just want to be clear on that point, that we're seeking to go forward. We feel very, very confident, especially with the legal advice we've received, to proceed forward. We'd like to do it just once. We believe we will be very successful. But if that is not true, there's a point when we receive that determination letter that they will tell us what they see is problematic, and we will have an opportunity to then make that correction.
Okay. Thank you. Melanie, we'll pick this back up on Wednesday. Tuesday, we want to take up, Mr. Harvey, you may want to stay around. We're going to take up House Speed 362, which is the BSA for, base student allocation. We had some discussion on that last week. We'll also take up House Bill 496, House Bill 426, House Bill 304, and there's another finance bill that's going to be read across tomorrow, referring to increasing authority for Hatcher Pass. It's a ADA bill, I believe. So we want to take up those House bills on Tuesday, and then we'll continue this on Wednesday. And then I think committee members can plan on doing double duty again. Well, probably till the end of session now. So 8:30 to 10, and then again at 1:30 to whenever we finish. So with that, I appreciate everybody's endurance the past this past week, and we won't be meeting tomorrow. And I hope everybody has a pleasant and restful Easter, and we'll see you Tuesday morning at, we're going to start Tuesday at 10 because session's at 2 o'clock. So we'll go 10 to noon and session at 2. Any questions? Okay, so we're adjourned.
Like I say, nice, sir.